optimistic about the way that things are going.
So I never ever think of it at all.
Don't you ever worry when you see what's going down.
Well, I try to mind my business, that is no business at all.
When it's time to function as a feeling human being, will your bachelor of arts help you?
Always, although he's a trumpet player, he had taught himself how to play guitar, and for many of the years that we traveled, Lee and Terry would share rooms, and you know, so Terry was always playing, and Lee had his guitar, and he was always playing. They were playing together and separately, and something funny happened where, you know, Lee wrote the song and it became a hit, and Terry said, "That's it, you're not rooming with me anymore." Hi, this is Robert Lamb of Chicago, in the studio with Chicago 567.
The first two albums by the Windy City Septet Chicago totaled no less than 8 vinyl sides of high horsepower rock music, supercharged by brass, blowing like 8 cylinders in a muscle car, while yielding half a dozen top 20 singles. Chicago's third double album had that same everything but the kitchen sink musical philosophy, but with mixed results. While Chicago's fourth release tested the limits of fan loyalty as well as their wallets with a self-indulgent box set recorded live at prestigious Carnegie Hall. For their fifth album, released in July 1972, Chicago's lineup remained underappreciated singer-guitarist Terry Kath, bass guitar singer Peter Cetera, drummer Danny Serafin, trombonist Jim Panko, trumpet player Lee Loughnane, sax and woodwinds Walter Perizzater, and keyboard vocalist, songwriter Robert Lamb, who joined me in the studio.
At that point, we had felt we had kind of pushed CBS to the wall with the Carnegie Hall package. We were prepared to do another double album, but I think we thought that at this point we should give them a break and maybe even give ourselves a break. And we sensed that freeform things and lengthy solos perhaps were less interesting to everybody, including us, than more structured stuff, you know, like Saturday in the Park.
My mother was a jazz aficionado, and she had a great collection of 78s, and she listened to Errol Garner and all the big bands from the swing era, you know, Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, Count Basie, Duke Ellington. She had all those. And When she wasn't playing those records, she was listening to the radio stations that that programmed that stuff. So that was really my first exposure to music, you know, to popular music.
So it's no surprise the band that you ended up making your mark in.
Yeah.
You came by it really honestly.
Although, you know, the facts of my life and, you know, the moving around my family did, it still seems to me a coincidence that I ended up in a band like this.
The
day I got the phone call from it was either Danny Serafin or Walt Parizader, when they were putting together the basis of what this band was going to be. I mean, they just heard about this kid who was playing keyboards and singing on the south side of Chicago. They just heard about him, and they called him one day and to ask him if he was interested in joining a band that had brass in it. They were going to try to do a rock and roll band with brass. And, you know, I didn't know these guys, and I wasn't expecting the call, but I said, sure, because I wasn't really doing anything that was exciting me at the time. I was playing in a basic, you know, four-man rock and roll combo, you know.
Why did they tell you at the time or even later on, why did you get the call? Was it your singing that hooked them?
Or? Yeah, they needed a keyboard player. They thought they needed a keyboard player who could sing, and as it turned out, you know, I was playing Hammond organ. I was kicking bass pedals. So they needed somebody. They didn't have a bass player. So the fact that I could play bass pedals, actually the fact that I didn't know if I could play bass pedals, but I was willing to try, that was what got me the job. That was what got me, you know, the tryout, as it were.
No kidding.
Yeah.
July.
single Saturday in the Park, written and sung by Robert Lamb, preceded the full album's release, and by peaking at number 3 was Chicago's first appearance in the top 5 singles chart. It certainly would not be their last. Here's Robert Lamb.
I carried a Super 8 movie camera around with me for the first few years we traveled, and I was looking at a reel one day of all, you know, sort of all my reels kind of spliced together in one long reel, and there was a section of it that's Central Park in New York City in the summer in 1969. We're in New York, and I think we just played the Fillmore, and we're kind of gathering forces to go down and play at the Atlanta Pop Festival. It's like, I think it's actually the 4th of July, and I've got just some footage of me kind of wandering around the park, you know, sort of like love-in type thing, you know, where they close the park off and, you know, people kind of actually come out and use the park. And then later on in the reel, I happen to be in New York the next year on July 4th, and there's more footage of, you know, people kind of riding their bicycles with balloons tied to them and that kind of stuff. So I kind of ran that film. I kept running those two sections, and looking at it, and I wrote lyrics to describe what I was seeing. So in a sense, Saturday in the Park is like a little film score. I actually woke up in the middle of the night in, like, you know, a Holiday Inn somewhere, and without turning the lights on, you know, just kind of the light coming through the window, wrote down the words, and I heard the tune in my head, and you know, I heard it exactly the way it came out.
Chicago's mentor, manager, and producer in the studio was James William Guercio. Though not an actual band member, Jim Guercio was the mayor of Chicago in every sense of the term. Again, Robert Lamb.
Jimmy Guercio had always talked about, you know, the utopian situation of you know, having our own studio so we could get into the studio anytime we want and, you know, do our little demos, or, you know, just kind of be in a constant process of writing, you know, maybe in a situation where we would all live in close proximity to each other, you know, kind of, you know, in wilderness is our preservation. That whole Thoreau philosophy was something that Guercio strongly believed in and was trying to infuse into the group. When we were recording Chicago 5 in New York, we would stop recording and take a dinner break, and he would set up a movie camera and project movies of properties that he was having real estate guys all over the country looking for, you know, acreage that, you know, with buildings that could be converted to studios, you know, because he really wanted to do this thing, and he was really trying to, you know, get the rest of the band enthused, you know, about actually making this move.
Optimistic about the way that things are going.
No, I never ever think of it at all.
Don't you ever worry when you see what's going down.
Well, I try to mind my business, that is no business at all.
When it's time to function as a feeling human being, will your bachelor of arts help you?
Thank you.
Chicago's Dialogue Part 1 and 2, though it featured the distinctive voices of Terry Kath and Peter Cetera, was one of eight songs written by solely Robert Lamb. I asked Robert why such a big band relied on one songwriter for Chicago 5.
The trick of collaboration is completely being completely open to someone else's ideas and also completely bearing your soul to somebody else. It takes a certain amount of maturity to be willing to do that. It takes a lot of trial and error. So I think at that point, we maybe weren't mature enough to do that.
Chicago 5 not only was the band's first number one seller, it occupied the top spot for 9 weeks. Next, the Roman numerals get bigger, and so do the successes for Chicago. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear more exclusive interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Robert Lamb, In the Studio, the top seller, Chicago 5.
Welcome back. This is Robert Lamb of Chicago in the studio with Chicago 5 here with Redbeard.
Thank you, Robert. It's important for you to realize that songwriters, whether or not they perform the songs, get paid royalties for every use of their song, including actual music sales, but also radio airplay, TV, videos, live performances, sheet music, movie soundtracks, everything. So songwriters in a recording band that sells significant quantities get a double portion payday, a hard fact that has caused bands to break up as much as anything. Here's Robert Lamb of Chicago.
We had always done a thing where the writing members would share a portion of their writing royalties with the non-writing members, which is unheard of. Because basically Jimmy, Panko, Terry Kath, and myself were writing, you know, 95% of the stuff. So there were four other guys in the band, you know, who the income was beginning to be a little lopsided. So Guercio brought the writers together and said, what do you think about this idea? You know, you take X percent and kick it into a fund, to a pool, and then redistribute it equally among everybody else. We said, fine, we'll do that, but what we think that everybody in this band is capable of writing, and we would like to see everybody, you know, I mean, we'd like to give everybody a shot.
Thank you.
For me and millions of others, Chicago was the bridge to a whole world of jazz and big band music that was never exposed on American Top 40 radio. Again, here's Robert Lamb.
We really have not thought about the result too much. About the only planning we ever did was, you know, just like schedule sessions. And, you know, we had no agenda, really, other than, you know, to just pretty much to record the songs that had been written. You know, all that's changed very much now. But at that point, Guercio was encouraging us to just keep writing and we'll record it. That was the last time, though. That record was the last time where we were able to pull that off.
Sung by co-writer Peter Cetera, Feeling Stronger Every Day had spectacular horn arrangements, which gave Chicago such a distinctive sound.
Jimmy Pankow And Peter Cetera, you know, almost by magic came up with that song. And I couldn't tell you, you know, which part belonged to whom. But at this point, Peter had been very secretive about and very insecure about his writing. You know, it would only be after a few drinks very late at night that, you know, I would go over to his little house where he was living in West Hollywood, and he'd pull out an acoustic guitar and play these wonderful songs for me. You know, he had some kind of, you know, I guess insecurity about his writing. And, you know, I always said, you know, these songs are great, man. You know, why don't you present them? You know, why don't we do them?
Chicago 6, released in June 1973, was 50% composed by the prolific Robert Lamb, but the number 4 hit Just You and Me and the top 10 Feeling Stronger Every Day were both written by Chicago trombonist Jim Panko.
I think it was probably the first soprano saxophone solo, jazz soprano saxophone solo in a rock tune ever to be charted. The only other thing I can even recall slightly related to it is Paul Desmond's solo on Take 5. That song, you know, that song, we still play that song in concert, and I have as much fun playing that song as any song. It's, you know, one of those things where you actually get to play. Jimmy Panko and his wife, Karen, had announced their plans to be married, and the announcement, either the wedding announcement or the invitation, had the title page of the sheet music reproduced on its cover. So rather than having sort of an engraved traditional invitation, it was the first sheet of that song which he had written for Karen.
When we come back, the blockbuster album Chicago 7 and the tragic death of guitarist, singer-songwriter Terry Kath. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and click on more classic rock interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Chicago's Robert Lamb in the studio for Chicago 6.
Welcome back. This is Robert Lamb of Chicago in the studio with Chicago 5, 6, 7 here with Redbeard.
Thanks once again, my friend. On the 1973 tour to support the Chicago 6 album, the band had been mixing in some new compositions featuring lengthy jazz instrumentals. While the audience reaction was mixed, nevertheless, when the members of Chicago assembled for what became their seventh album, there was debate among band members and producer-manager Jim Guercio on what direction to take musically. Oh, and let's not forget the record company. They had an opinion on Chicago 7 as well. According to Chicago singer, songwriter, keyboard player Robert Lamb with me in the studio.
With the degree of success we had been having, everybody around us, the business people, management, and the record company were saying, this is so great, we must find a way to sustain it. And it fills a niche that nobody else is filling. What we were beginning to get, though, from the record company a little bit was, especially after Feeling Stronger Every Day, was go ahead and do what you guys are going to do, but make sure that there's a hit on each album. We're getting to get a little bit of that message from the record company. We love the fact that you guys are being successful and you're selling records, but the reason you're selling them is because you're having hit singles. So, be careful.
Strange news.
saxophonist Jimmy Pankow scored another songwriting hit with I've Been Searching So Long on Chicago 7. So full of long jazzy numbers as well as tight pop chestnuts that the band decides to once again release a double album in March 1974. Again, Robert Lamb.
Danny Serafin and Walter Parizader and Lee Loughnane and Peter Cetera, everybody is writing now. And so there are four more people working towards composing, and that made for more material. And the basic project, the basic objective of this band was, you know, for total expression and support for each other's creativity. So that, you know, that made it almost necessary, almost, you know, absolutely necessary to do a double album. And also we wanted to stretch out more. You know, I think we were encouraged by the success of Just You and Me and the jazzy solo in the middle. You know, we thought that we maybe had been neglecting our jazz instincts a little bit, so we pursued that on Chicago 7.
having a Chicago song go to number 6 by now was no surprise. In the case of Call on Me from Chicago 7, it was the source of the song, Trumpeter Lee Loughnane, that was impressive. The fact that the band Chicago was now based out of their Caribou Ranch facility in Colorado also gave rise to a long musical and business relationship with some unlikely peers on Chicago 7, according to Robert Lamb.
When we would go to Caribou to do 4 or 6 weeks of recording, we would always pass through Denver and then take a bus from the Denver airport to Caribou. And we had just gotten off the plane and we were down at the luggage carousel. And who do we see? We see the Beach Boys, who were coming into Denver to play a show. So we sort of introduced ourselves. Hi, how are you, Chicago? We're going to Caribou to record. And Peter popped the question to Carl. You know, Peter said, you know, would you guys be interested in coming up and have dinner with us at the ranch, take a look around, and, you know, maybe sing on something? And they said, great, we'll be up there tomorrow.
As top-selling albums and singles go, Chicago is second only to, coincidentally, the Beach Boys as America's most popular band. And Chicago 7 was one of the reasons why, landing at number 1 in the sales slot. But a dark day indeed lay off in the not-too-distant future when the triple threat secret weapon of Chicago, lead guitarist, baritone singer, songwriter Terry Kath, died suddenly of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Unfounded theories and conjecture surrounded the shocking, tragic incident, implying that Terry Kath may have been so frustrated with the business and the musical side of Chicago that he would have taken his own life. But according to the band's Robert Lamb, there was one witness to the Kath shooting that dismisses the suicide theory.
We had just completed a very successful 1977 tour. We had done a world tour and then gone back and sort of done another half a world tour, a world and a half tour. And everybody was pretty burned and, very tired. And something happened with Jimmy Gersio, and I to this day don't know exactly what it was, you know, something physiological. But the upshot of it was that we fired him. You know, we fired him. The relationship had gone completely south. And so there was a lot of disarray. There was a lot of discord. There was a lot of confusion, fear, anxiety, individually and collectively. Now, you know, I think that plays a role in what happened to Terry. Now, Terry had always been a sportsman, an outdoorsman, you know, a collector and aficionado of guns and motorcycles and cars, you know. And he was, we were sort of still in this turmoil, and he was, he wasn't feeling real good. And the story that I've heard from one of my keyboard tech, who was sharing a house with Terry, was that Terry had come over to the house to play for a while. He had a complete, you know, guitar rig set up, and he would just come over there and just play whenever he felt like, and he would leave. And he had just finished playing. He was feeling actually pretty good that day. And they were just sitting across from each other in the living room. And he had an automatic gun. Now, I have read that he was playing Russian roulette. Well, you don't play Russian roulette with an automatic weapon because it doesn't work. You know, it doesn't spin. Apparently, he had been cleaning the gun, and the cartridge was empty, but he had forgotten that there was a round chambered. And he just was sort of toying with the gun, had the gun in his hand, and pulled the trigger and hit himself squarely in the side of the head from like an angle that was sort of down near his side rather than, you know, right at his temple. So, I'm convinced that it was accidental. And, all the stories that I've heard about being suicide or being Russian roulette, I know are not true.
Sleepless hours and dreamless nights and faraways.
Ooh, wishing you were, wishing you were here. shows when I'm away.
That's Terry Kath on the lower lead vocals on Chicago's number 11 hit, Wishing You Were Here, featuring the unmistakable backing voices of the Beach Boys. Terry Kath was so essential to the sound and success of the band Chicago that Robert Lamb questions the validity of a band named Chicago without Kath.
I've always felt that, you know, the band forever changed from being Chicago. Even after the initial period of grief over loss had passed, I felt strongly that really we ought to just change the name of the band because it's not the same band. It's not a real rational thing to do because, you know, we're talking about the careers of six other people and the security of their families and commitments to the record company and a public which loves the music and the band. So, you know, the decision was made to go on, and, you know, so there's still a Chicago today. But in my mind, the chemistry was gone when Terry died. You know, so what is left is the name of the band, the surviving members, and some new members, you know, building upon, you know, the first 11 albums. And but it doesn't have, for me, it doesn't have the same cohesiveness, urgency, depth without Terry. It's got different depth.
Looking back a few short years when we made our plans and played the cards the way they fell, clinging to our confidence, we stood on the threshold of the goal that we knew dear. And though we had our fights, had our short-tempered nights, it couldn't pull our dreams apart.
Well, you know, the attitude from the day that we all got together in Walter's basement and played all afternoon, and we said to each other, you know what, this sounds good. This sounds so good that we're going to do this. And we all shook hands, you know, with the exception of Peter Cetera, who wasn't there yet. But we all shook hands and we said, let's just go for this. Let's just do this. Let's just, I don't even remember what the words were, but it was a feeling, it was like, you know, like a sort of a blood brotherhood thing. You know, it was an agreement to go and do this experiment and not be denied or something. You know, we won't be denied. It was fairly dramatic and kind of stupid in a college kid kind of way, but we always think about it. I mean, lately especially, we just had our band anniversary dinner.
Just
Oh, we're real proud of it, and we're real proud of it. And well, you know, somehow we knew that if one of the things that could deter us is if, you know, one guy got in the limelight too much, you know, or one guy started getting more attention, or one guy started getting, you know, getting the record company blowing in his ear real hard, or the industry in general, or, you know, all the stuff that we didn't know from any kind of experience, but we just had a hunch about it that, you know, we could do this thing together better than if it dissipated into just a group of individuals, a group of personalities, a group of guys who are out for themselves. You know, and it's not. So we've been blessed with being able to, you know, get some maturity and be able to look at it and appreciate it for what it is.
Merely by chance, very unsuspecting, you caught my heart, unprotecting me. Now I'm falling in love with you. Just when
Redbeard in the studio. See Robert Lamb and Jimmy Panko on tour with Chicago all this summer. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly. For Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2012, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear lots more classic rock interviews and live performances at inthestudio.net.